the Podfix Network.
Hello and welcome to episode 246 of the Filmmakers Podcast. This is a podcast where we talk
filmmaking
from indie film to studio films and
everything in between,
how to get them made, how to make them, and how to try not to
fuck it up
in our very, very humble opinion. Welcome to the show. Thank you so much for listening. We are delighted to have on this week's episode Chris Miller and Phil Lord. Oh yes, absolute legends of the game. They have directed, written, or produced between them, mainly together, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. What a start, by the way. They've got so many special thanks in movies like How to Train Your Dragon and Megamind and Hugo. And then they directed 21 Jump Street. After that, they went Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs 2, The Lego Movie, 22 Jump Street, Rigsby Bear, which I loved, Lego Batman Movie, Lego Ninjago Movie, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, Lego Movie 2, and The Mitchells vs. The Machines, which is out now on the wonderful Netflix. Oh yeah. We didn't get to chat. Myself and Christian James. Hello, Christian.
Hey, bud. How you doing?
Yeah, I'm all right, mate.
I got very excited because I thought you were going to say, today we have with us, and I thought you were going to say Christian James, but you said Phil Lord and Chris Miller. And I was like, oh, the audience is going to be really disappointed now. They'll be like...
Hugely.
Yeah, they'll be like, he's going to say Christian James? Oh, it's only Phil Lord and Chris Miller. Oh, only the Oscar winners.
But now I have come back with Christian James, and the crowd went wild.
I could feel that.
what we didn't talk about, CJ, was Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. We didn't talk about that, but we did talk about Cocaine Bear, their brand new film that they're making right now. CJ, what else did we talk about?
Oh, we covered so much. I just have to caveat this with saying, obviously, with people like Phil and Chris, where they've got a career as big as they have, it's really hard to cover as much as they've done, so we have to like dip in and out of various things. But we covered like their beginning in filmmaking, dealing with rejection, and they talked a lot about how filmmakers should be more unique. And I suppose Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs is a great example of that, and how they brought their voice to that and it elevated them onwards.
We also talk about writing together, how they do that, how they collaborate with other people, and where they get their ideas from.
Also, we cover the difference between working together or alone on a script versus is being on a set with loads of people, massive crew, and making those, and the differences between making animation versus live action.
In which case, we jump into talking about Jump Street and Last Man on Earth with that as well,
yeah,
don't we?
We do, cover some of those classics.
And then we dive into Lego Movie a little bit and why they added 10 minutes when the studio told them it was too long. We also talk about the fantastic The Mitchells versus the Machines. All that is to come on the Filmmakers Podcast. How are you, buddy, CJ? How are you?
Good, thanks, G-Man. I was a little rusty in the intro. It's been a while. But the beauty of this particular podcast was not only hanging out with in person with Phil Lord and Chris Miller, but it was also hanging out with those fine chaps and yourself for the first time in, I think, 2 years. I haven't seen you in the flesh for 2 years.
That's crazy. That was crazy. It was really lovely to see you. And actually, again, it's like the Jim Cummings episode. It was so nice to sit in a room and have a chat with filmmakers. And Chris and Phil were, I mean, they were brilliant. As soon as they arrived, you were like, oh, this is going to be good. They're funny, they're on it, interesting, happy to give advice. I really enjoyed that a lot. Big thank you to James from Netflix for setting it up for us. Thank you. If you're not subscribed to Netflix, why not? Go watch this. Go watch this movie right now. The Mitchells versus the Machines. You're not with your usual lovely microphone. You're with, clearly, iPhone headpods. Where are you? Why are you there?
I like the fact you call them headpods.
Yeah, it's a mixture.
Got my headpods in. I'm in Copenhagen. Yeah, I'm shooting an ad out here. A docu-commercial. All the kids love it. Docu-commercials is the... So I'm doing one of those bad boys. So
it's a new thing. What's the difference between an ad and a docu-commercial?
I think it's a way for creatives to charge more money. So,
brilliant. Yeah, great. Well, you're happy then.
we're going to give you a docu-commercial, and they bring someone like me to make that, and it's all, it's legitimate, it's real world, it's, you know, getting real people, but making it look like a commercial. So that's where I come in. So there you go. Glamorous. That's what I'm out here doing. It's cold. It's quite nice though. It's autumnal. It's beautiful.
Well, first of all, I just wanted to let you lovely people know that I'm in the edit at the moment for Wolves of War, the war film, starring Ed Westwick and Rupert Graves and Matt Willis. I am super pumped for it. It's really exciting to sit in the edit and do that World War II film. I'm really excited by that. It's been great. So yeah, my concentration's been on that and wrapping up 3 Day Millionaire a bit in the last sort of 2 weeks since we wrapped, 3 weeks now maybe. There's a lot to do, CJ. Giles, there's a lot of paperwork.
No, very, very, very quickly, this is quite important, this question. If you had to burn the digital negatives of one of those movies, you had to, your life depends on it, you've got to destroy one of those movies right now, which one would you pick?
My life depends on it, right? Yeah. Yeah. I'd burn myself rather than do that. Yeah, I can't ask that question.
So diplomatic. I don't think you would. I think you would choose.
Which who do you prefer? Your child or your wife? You know what I mean? No, answer me. Your life depends on it.
I asked you first, so you have to answer mine before I answer yours.
No, we can't answer that. I think, they're all your babies. You can't help it, can you? I think when you make a film, and even if there was problems or there's issues or things that you weren't as happy with as a director producer, they're still yours. You're still passionate about it and love it with all its heart and all its foibles. Cool, like your child. But thank you for putting me on the spot and asking really awkward, difficult question. We have some shout outs to give to just general lovely, amazing people who listen to the podcast, give us so much lovely feedback. They are Lindsay Fraser, Brett Liddick, William Smith, Ben McHugh, Caden Alley, Daniel Thrace, who are newcomers. Welcome, boys. And Mark Coleman, Rick Kaplan, George Solis. And huge shout out to our Patreon listeners. You are stars. Those of you who got the extra bonus clips from last week, if you are on the Patreon, you got them. You would love them. I really hope you did listen to them because they're fantastic, with Axel Carolyn and then Jim Cummings and PJ McCabe as well. Oh my gosh. Really cool. So if you're not getting the Patreon yet, you haven't joined our tribe, then do. Link to that is in the show notes. Come and join us. Come and get some great bonus material. Oh yeah. And our merch, CJ, for Christmas.
Yeah.
Christmas is coming up. It's crazy. We have 15% off our merch. We have t-shirts and mugs and hoodies and gosh, some really cool stuff. So if you want a Christmas present for a filmmaker friend of yours, can't go wrong.
Or not. They could be, did it have to be a filmmaker friend? Maybe someone that just likes, maybe someone that wears t-shirts.
Yeah. Or it could just be you. You know what I mean? You could buy it for yourself. There is that. And also our blog at the moment, it's going great guns. So basically, we cut down some of the best bits and we put them onto our blog. So do go check that out as well. It's free. Why not? It's on our website, thefilmmakerspodcast.com, where you can get all our back catalogue of podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts in the world. But anyway, that is the blog. So, CJ, shall we get to today's episode?
Let's do it.
This is the fantastic Christopher Miller and Phil Lord, legendary director, writer and producers on our podcast for you lovely people. Sit back, relax and enjoy.
Hello, hi Giles. How are you guys?
So nice to meet you. I'm Giles.
How are you? How's it going?
You just come from Aardman. You're allowed to talk about that. The studio's there.
Yeah, we were just in beautiful Bristol, visiting with Peter Lord over there.
Any relation?
Sadly.
It was great to walk around. Was it your first visit there?
We'd been back in 2009, but it was great to see the operations. There's something really cool about how tactile the stop motion is and these incredible sets that they've got, and just the inventiveness of that place is really magical.
You remember that, like, filmmaking is all, you know, everything is a prototype. If you're making something, if you're making an animated movie, it's an experimental film. Every film is an experimental film. And you really get that sense of, like, oh yeah, we have to solve this problem. How are we going to create this grass? Well, maybe we can take this material with a fork and just kind of fluff it out and it'll look right. That kind of problem solving is so germane to animation, and it reminds us of being students. And so it's great. And then, speaking of students, Peter Lord is like a guy that we've studied, you know, since we were kids, and like watching his films and wanting to be in the animation business. It's a real trip to meet him in person and then have him seem happy to see us.
So you're meeting your heroes as well. So how is that, you know, how does that feel to
you know.
They say always meet your heroes. That's what they
say. That's what they say. Yeah.
You must have met a fair few of your heroes.
We have met a lot of heroes.
Can we? No, no, no. I'm not going to go there. I don't know. Yeah.
No,
so
but
which ones?
We met Miyazaki once for 30 seconds.
Did you? How was that?
Wow. It was great. He said, keep making animated films. And he made us promise, and then we did.
And then you did. Yeah. He also didn't just do that. Right, well, that was the thing. You actually thing he lied. Was saying,
oh, no, well, we were already making some live action, some animated, and he told us through an interpreter to not stop making animated films.
It sounds like a swipe at Jump Street to me.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, he was like, oh, you really should...
He's taking a hit.
He yeah, was apparently. A huge Jump Street fan.
Right. As he should be.
Of course.
He's brilliant. Yeah. He's brilliant.
You have should have had him against the wall. I think.
Yeah, you like,
what'd you say?
Yeah, how dare you?
Yeah.
But were you talking then about being students and actually that feeling of students? You met, right? When you went to the same...
University.
True fact, wasn't it? It's got an English name as well where you went.
Dartmouth.
Yeah.
Sounds very
fancy sounding.
Very British.
But was it fancy?
No, I mean.
Okay.
Yeah, it's in the upper valley of New Hampshire and Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
It's a decidedly unfancy place.
Right.
I had a friend, a mutual friend, who said to both of us, I met someone just as weird as you. And
serious.
And sort of true. Set us up as friends. And here we are.
Then you lit my girlfriend's hair on fire.
It is true.
And well, we became close friends afterwards. Yeah.
It's a real bonding experience.
How did that happen? How did you?
Chris okay, was well, playing a little game.
Yeah, yeah. She was
that
playing.
You guys have probably played before
she was
too.
Playing like a Tetris type game on the computer, and I was playing a game called Let's See How Close I Can Get This Lighter to Heather's Hair Without Her Noticing.
Great game.
I mean, who doesn't
I won
that
the game, obviously, because her hair caught on went fire.
No, she didn't know what was going on. She didn't flinch.
Yeah, so she was like,
realize she only
it.
Flinched when I was like blowing it out. And then she's like, what are you doing? I was like, oh, I gotta go.
For the next 30 days, her hair smelled.
Yeah. Burnt hair is a bad smell.
Yeah. It really is. And you put up with that? You were like, you accepted this both from your girlfriend and from him?
It definitely hurt the relationship.
Between you and her. But it, yeah. It's a mental
it
relationship
made
between
friends.
Us.
Yeah.
For life.
How burnt was her hair?
I mean, she had a little
just
patch.
The top
just
layer.
Patch.
Right. Yeah. Just the top.
Yeah, so you can just, like, you wouldn't, you know, visually. It was
oh, only the top. Not, right. Yeah. Nothing
yeah.
important.
Yeah, just the, yeah, exactly.
Just the part you can see. I mean, yeah.
Was it the pink bits? Was it just the
yeah.
tips?
Just,
right?
Yeah, just, yeah.
I was giving
yeah,
a little.
Just the
it was
bits.
90s, right?
That's
yeah.
Yes.
It was 90s when everything was great.
Everything was really.
Yeah.
You could burn hair back then, and it was okay. You can't do it now.
You would go to the salon and make the roots darker, please.
Please, yeah. Yeah, because everyone is every different color.
Because of woke culture, I can't burn hair anymore. It's really annoying.
It's really
annoying.
Yeah. But you met there. But where did the idea, the inspiration to start coming up with, you know, ideas, sort of writing bits and pieces?
Well, Chris was going to take a useful government class.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked him out of that and into an animation class with me that spring.
Imagine where you could be now.
Yeah. I know. I
if
could
he
be,
hadn't done
oh my
that.
Gosh. I could be a state senator somewhere. And
sure.
That wow. would be the worst. We did a lot of, you know, the creative nonsense in college, like humor magazines and comic strips.
Yeah, you were
and,
writing all
and,
sorts, weren't you?
And obviously the animation and film classes and stuff. So we started helping each other out on each other's student films and then moved out to Los Angeles. We decided we were going to move out to LA to make it in the movie business.
Mm-hmm.
And we sort of accidentally became a team.
Well, you did tell us a story, because there's a really interesting story about how you actually got spotted, if you like. And it's one of these things where you go, how do you get spotted? How did things happen? But actually, I think
in
your
a nightclub, like models.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, look at this. Walking down
an animation nightclub.
Everyone's just animated.
And Peter
literally.
Lord walks through and he's wearing this huge, you know,
huge.
Fur coat.
He's like the Andy Warhol of
the fork. And he's like, who are those lads?
He's dressed as Shaun the Sheep there.
He's dressed, yeah. He was there. He rode in on a sheep.
You mean what the true story?
The true story.
Is there was, we were very lucky in that there was an article that was written about me in the sort of university alumni magazine that was, there was a guy.
The title of the article was The Next Dr. Seuss?
Because Dr. Seuss had gone to our school.
Ah,
The answer is no, by the way.
Jake Tapper, right?
Jake Tapper.
Yeah, famous American newsman.
Yeah, he was not famous at that point.
No, he was a Dartmouth alum.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Michael Eisner, who was the head of Disney at the time, his son had gone to the same school as us, but we didn't know him. And so he would get these magazines as a mailer to try and get people to get him to donate money.
The name of the magazine is Please Give Us Money Magazine.
It's a great magazine. Yeah, it's still going.
It didn't really work. I don't think he ever did. But he did see There's this article time. About me and then pass it on to an underling who passed it to an underling who called me in my off-campus apartment.
And it was sort of a game of telephone. By the time it got to this, you know, banana number four, it went from being like, hey, I don't know, check these guys out, to like, these are Eisner's boys. Give them a job.
So we showed up and they offered us a job straight having graduated. We were very super lucky. It was a total privilege.
You would say we were super privileged.
We made the most of it.
And what was the job? The job was to
make up Saturday morning TV shows. And at that time, that was like the main outlet for animation. And we failed.
Yeah. Nothing ever went on the air.
Okay.
Yeah. We bombed. We pitched like 7 shows. They were pretty... One was about... conjoined twins who ran a toy store.
It could still happen.
Yeah.
So at this time, what would have been around you? What were you influenced by? And what was the animation scene like at that time?
It was all like kind of classy situation comedies that were animated for kids, like Recess and Doug. And, you know, that the things that Disney were making at that moment were pretty straight.
But on the air was obviously The Simpsons was on the air, and that was a big touchstone for us.
Yeah, South Park.
South Park had just started. Literally, the first episode aired while we were on this deal, and it shook up the world so much so that even though we failed at this first job to ever make a show that went on kids' television, there was this new burgeoning industry of more adult-oriented animation that the siren song came calling to us, and there were places.
It made us look really bankable.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, a lot of people made big mistakes, wasted a lot of money on us.
A lot of that. And then how long you were there coming up with ideas before they sort of things started to get serious and you went,
We spent a year at Disney making kids cartoons that didn't go anywhere. And then we moved over to the adult side of Disney called Touchstone Television. Mm-hmm. And there we developed this show called Clone High, which we made ultimately for MTV. And that was our first show that we ever made.
They took it on and it eventually became a really nice series of sorts. You know what I mean? Yeah. It was like, for you guys, it must have been finally, right?
It was kind of a great like English series. It was like on for, you know, like 10 episodes and then that was it.
But now it's coming back after 20 years later.
It's back now. Yes. And with our friend Bill Lawrence, who was, you know, now of Ted Lasso fame.
Indeed.
But at the time he was, you know, 30 years old on a television deal and wanted to mentor other writers, and we were the only people there that were younger than him. So he was like, I guess they'll do.
Yeah, I'll hang on with these two.
Yeah. And then he made this show called Scrubs, and it was were shooting in an abandoned hospital. There was a wing of the hospital that nobody wanted to go into because it was the former psych ward, and the doors only opened from the outside, and it was scary.
As it should. Yeah. In the psych ward.
And so he was like, you guys want a free office? To make your TV show
in? And we said, yes, we needed all the money we could get to make the show. So having free office space was really helpful.
You just couldn't get out.
Even though it was creepy. It was creepy.
You couldn't get out.
Yeah.
Until we finished.
Something.
One of the writer's offices had the number 4 etched into the walls and doors and windows everywhere, just thousands and thousands of times from a previous tenant of the psych ward. It was creepy. It was creepy.
It wound up in Jump Street.
That's right.
That's why Channing draws the number 4 a million times.
Oh, that's kind of cool.
Yeah, it's like a little inside joke for just us.
For just you.
Yeah.
No, and the person that drew the 4.
And the person. That person. They're like, finally.
And anyone in that ward.
Yeah, he or she knew. Yes. They would have known. But where did those ideas come from back then? And what did it feel like? Because it is interesting for us to talk about the sort of the times when it didn't go right, you know, the times when you were struggling, because it's great to talk about the happy times. And of course, we'll talk about Mitchells versus Machines and Lego Movie and all that kind of Jump Street. But in terms of the times when we're struggling, because so many people who listen to this podcast, we're in that position, we're struggling.
Yeah.
What did it feel like then? And how did you keep coming up with new ideas and that rejection? Talk us through that.
Well, it was interesting because, you know, in our early days, we would pitch these shows that we thought were really interesting and unique, and the higher ups weren't interested, and they wanted things that they kept saying, more Disney. And that was a little bit discouraging because, you know, we were like, well, how are we gonna, you know, do something that we want to do that feels like, it has some sort of corporate mandate on top of it. And we tried to find ways around it, clever ways around it, and not just sort of acquiesce and do what we thought they wanted to see, because I think that is the recipe for failure.
Our response to the more Disney comment was, we tried to think of the worst Disney movie that had ever been made.
Which is, in your opinion?
it's close. The Cat from Outer Space was the one that we chose.
It's a live action movie with Ken Berry and Sandy Duncan and a cat who comes from outer space.
And to save money, they wrote into the script that the cat speaks through thought transference.
Love it.
Meaning its mouth doesn't have to move.
Cheap.
So half the movie is just the cat sitting there with his head sort of resting.
I'm going to check this out.
There's a whole conversation.
And just
happening.
Having a conversation with Ken Berry, we're like, this is great. All the shows that were getting on the air were adaptations of like Dalmatians and stuff. So we were like, oh, great. We'll adapt this, the crummiest Disney movie ever made.
Of course.
And here's the bonus. You won't have to animate the mouth. All the shots of the cat, he can just sit there.
And the bar is low, so you haven't got like, oh, it's not like the classic. So you, it's already, you know.
No one's saying like, you're ruining my childhood from this one.
It was the only pitch they liked.
Yeah. Of course they liked it.
Love it.
And then we go, oh no.
Yeah.
We had a few times where we started making things that we were sort of maybe a little bit on the soulless side. And we regretted it every time. So we learned pretty early that you gotta just make something that you want to see. And thankfully, I think studios and money people are different than they were back then in the late 90s.
Yeah, now uniqueness drives the marketplace. It used to be like they were trying to find the biggest tent they could find, which just meant like, let's make something and shave it into the roundest sphere possible so that it can just sort of get through all the hoops. And then so there was a lot of like generic kind of boring stuff was made in that moment. And Clone High is like the opposite of that. It's just like, let's do every fun thing that we want. And we had been in writers' rooms on other shows where the showrunner would say, you need to beat this joke, but it needs to be the exact same thought. And so we're like, okay, we don't know how to do that.
Yeah.
And so we said, we want to be the showrunners that say yes. If you've got a wild idea, we want to figure out how to make it work. And so that was the philosophy of that room. And we just said yes to basically everything. And any whim that we had, we just started to play with it. We based an episode on a drawing of Scudworth with like a silly cravat. And we're like, this is such a funny drawing. Maybe we can design a whole episode around it.
But how great and how freeing, right?
It was really freeing, yeah.
It must have been.
Perhaps too freeing. Right.
maybe, but also amazing. Did you, because of all the sort of, let's say rejection, it's maybe the wrong word, of all the projects you tried, pitched and failed, suddenly to have one to
non-acceptance.
Non-acceptance, should we say. Every no is a slight yes, but just delivered in a no coat. but that must have felt great, like you said, to get that moving. And how did it help you as filmmakers at that point and creators and idea comer-uppers?
One thing that was, it was like a real film school, that show, because we didn't have the money to have a big crew. And so we ended up doing a lot of it, including storyboard revisions and animatic editing ourselves. So we had to learn how to use editing software and that sorts of things like that. So it was really helpful on that front, just to sort of do it all on some level. And then ultimately, now that we've been able to work with people who are so much better than us and all these different things, it's good to have that experience. And then, like Phil saying, that working with a writing staff and an art team with a bunch of people going like, what do you want to do? What do you want to see? What do you wish that we could do that we haven't been allowed to do? Because no one's quite minding the store right now, so we can get away with anything. And the spirit of feeling like you can get away with something was something that felt amazing, and it's something we've tried to do for the rest of our careers.
Yeah, and which you have, and I suppose going straight onto Cloud with a Chance of Meatballs, because again, this what you said there about being unique, I really like that. And I suppose that'll drive us into Cloudy, because you're saying now it's better if filmmakers are unique, they come up with something different. Can you just divulge a little more about that?
Yeah, so a funny thing happened while we were making Cloudy. We were at Sony Animation, and they had a movie come out that didn't perform how they wanted, so they spent $1 million getting NRG, a research company, to reverse engineer why animated movies succeed in the marketplace. And so the idea is like, let's just copy what they do, right? And we'll do that and we'll win. And the researchers said that the way to win is to be unique. It's the one factor that is common to all the winners, is that it has to be different. You can't be like the fourth Penguin movie. You have to like be something that nobody's seen before. And we've seen that over and over and over again. If you can deliver an experience that feels new to an audience, they go. And if it feels like something like, I've seen that before, you know, they stay home.
Which is the counter to any studio. Sure, they're like, they just want what's being done because they know it sells and they know it makes X amount.
But now I think, especially with the sort of changing marketplace, I think throughout film and television, people are banking on uniqueness and originality, because I think those are the things that get the attention and then drive people off their butts to go to a cinema. It has to be an experience, you know. It has to feel like, oh, I'm going on a ride, and it's going to be something I haven't ever felt before. Because there's a much of amazing television right now, especially for movies, studio heads are looking at going like, how can we be something that beats just sitting at home and watching something? And it has to feel something that's worth paying for a babysitter and making a whole evening out of. And so it has to feel like a new, exciting experience, that like going to a theme park or something and going on a roller coaster.
Mm-hmm. Right. Expensive. That's like when Avatar came out. It was like people's grandmothers were like, I want to go because I want to see that before I die.
Yes. Right.
You know, and then it's a completely different kind of movie, but we just wrapped this movie in Ireland called Cocaine Bear.
Yes.
Guess what it's about.
I heard
a bear on cocaine.
I've heard a lot about this.
But when you hear the phrase Cocaine Bear, you go, well, I haven't seen that before. Yeah.
Using real bears, obviously.
Obviously. Using,
I mean, we made a lot of
no bears were harmed during the filming, a lot of bears had a great time.
They're struggling now.
But they're doing better.
Yeah, there's a sequel plan.
Withdrawal Bear is the
the sad kind of Oscar play.
Barely
sequel.
Withers.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you mentioned not Disney, it's not Disney enough, your original pictures.
Yeah.
But now, X amount of movies in, do you think there is a Lord and Miller style? I don't want to say brand. I don't want to say it. But you know what I mean?
I hope not. I do think people think of that when they think about us.
I mean, I will say that there are things that we are attracted to and things that we aren't.
Yeah.
It would be hard for us to make a film that didn't have any sense of humor about it whatsoever, that was very self-serious. We also don't really love mean-spirited things.
Yeah.
We like to be fairly hopeful, and you know, I think a gritty coal miner drama that was incredibly bleak would be...
I can't wait to see you do that.
It would be interesting.
Be really bad at it, I think.
It would be unique.
It would be uniquely
or something like
terrible.
The Lighthouse or something like that. So you guys do something like that.
I think we try to have something interesting to say. We try to, you know, have it be relevant to what's going on in the world, and
we're not afraid of it being really dark.
Yes.
It's just that when in doubt, we're writing a scene and it doesn't work. When in doubt, we just make everybody really nice to each other, and it's an interesting way to like shake off the cobwebs of a scene.
What do you do then? What you touched on it there. When you are in a hole, when you are struggling, obviously you work together, which really helps. Mm-hmm. The writers who write on their own, it's like, I'm in a hole. How do I get out of it? But writing together, and maybe in rooms. But what happens when you hit a dark spot or a hole, or you know, you've written two drafts and you can't find the bit that ties it all together? What
two drafts? That would be amazing.
Yeah, I would love to just write two drafts. I mean, certainly when you talk to somebody else about it, two things happen, right? You have to turn it into a story that is told. So you eliminate details and add things intuitively to make it interesting. And that reveals a lot. And then you get somebody else's response to it. And then the conversation and watching that evolve. That's why writers' rooms can be great, is when people are talking, you come up with something together that you couldn't do apart.
Right. I mean, a lot of our writing is we're trying to make the other one laugh or be excited or interested. And then when we show the other one and we don't understand it, then it's a conversation. And as Phil's saying, you're forced to sort of explain what you are going for and sort of distill what's important to you. And that allows you to really understand what the goal of the scene is. And then, you know, because we're always sort of challenging each other to like, is this the most interesting way to do that? Or is this the clearest or the funniest or more surprising way to accomplish the goal of the scene? It's sort of, you're never in a hole that is impossible to get out of. You always have
a weird creative answer.
Right.
So we do like writing ourselves into corners. Mm-hmm. The other thing I do these days is I just think about the characters and what they're going through and how they feel. And a lot of times that unlocks something. And like I said, like I just go, well, maybe just if people were being really kind to each other right now, like what would they be doing?
Yes.
And a lot of times we've discovered that it's more spectacular to watch people try to get along than to watch them try to fight. You know, it's really, it sounds so hokey.
Well, that is the one thing that does run across a lot of your work that you either have directed or produced. It's always got a lot of heart to it. Mm-hmm. You can almost guarantee that whatever you've done, there's a warmth at the core of it. Does that make sense? You know, yes. And that must be something you know.
It didn't start that way, right. Funny enough. We didn't really realize that's, I mean, we like to think we're nice people and we like each other.
Yeah, okay.
we love the characters and we try to bring love to it. But, at the beginning, we just wanted to be funny, like desperately. And we would do anything and commit any heinous act to the characters in order to get there. And I think we had our first cut of Cloudy was every 7 minutes of it was hilarious, but if you put them all together, it puts you to sleep. And the reason is you really had no investment in the story. And we started working with this woman, Lindsay Duran, who's a great producer, produced a bunch of wonderful movies, including Dead Again, which I just watched again, which is brilliant. Lindsay is such a great producer for screenwriters that she has a whole part of her business, which is just like giving advice and notes to people. Okay. So she works on all of our screenplays and we just send it to her. She sends us a bunch of notes back and we just do them all because we've learned not to question her judgment.
No. She sounds amazing.
Yeah, she really is amazing. She makes you look good.
Yeah, absolutely, 100% she makes us look good.
Yeah. And she taught us the value of character and relationships and just watching people be kind. and it's made our writing a million times better.
It was Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs where we completely rewrote it to be more relationship focused and emotionally forward. That we were, after that, we were like, we'll never do anything ever again. And so now, instead of having to jam it in a reverse engineered way, we like start from the beginning going like, why do we care? And how is this going to break my heart? And
remember when Flint was like an aggrieved former famous weatherman and he was like had fallen from grace and was like really angry all the time to start the movie, and it just was like hard to get people to care.
But now you from the I think because the opening's got that Mark Mothersbaugh score, but Mothersbaugh
has
his score, the whole first sort of 5-10 minutes just flows, but you're almost in tears within 5 minutes.
And it's a beautiful score. Mark is one of the secret weapons in movies. He's the most melodic composer, I think, working now. And in an era where there's like a lot of stuff that is sort of anti-melody, he really knows how to bring warmth because he's a really warm guy, even though he wouldn't admit it. because he's also he's made made his name being in the most sarcastic band of all time.
Right, yeah.
True. And I think the score that he did for Mitchell's versus the Machines is really stunning. one of his best ever. It's
almost a return to Meatballs. It fits alongside it really nicely. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, how do you collaborate with people like that then? What is it, kind of you give them ideas and or they come to you with ideas or do they read the script?
In the case of Mitchell's, it was sort of this, we had with Mike, the director, this idea that, you know, the family would feel really analog and the world of PAL and the computers would be more synthesizers and beeps and boops and technology based sounds, and then these two things would collide and then find a sort of big orchestral synthesis of these two types of sounds by the end. And so Mark, who loves to collect weird instruments and experiment with strange noises in his scores, he was really excited about that and would embrace that. And so he would, you know, there's a lot of back and forth where he'd send little, I found this new thing, like, what do you think about this weird sound? And then Mike would be like, I love it, let's do that. And then sort of like picking different themes for each of the characters and having like those instrumentations of each of their characters sort of blend together and have the movie get bigger and bigger and more orchestral and cinematic, starting out in a sort of like an independent film score and becoming this big giant studio movie score by the end. And that was sort of the thinking.
When you work with Mark, he'll send you like 2 hours of like doodles.
Doodles?
Yeah, like just a bunch of fragments of things and like sketches that he's done and some stuff he wrote for you and some stuff that he just like had
left over from other things.
And then
he's like, oh, here's a theme that I always liked, but I did it for this other movie, but no, they never wanted it. And so you listen to all that stuff and then you go, ooh, this is great. This thing, in minute 42 is amazing.
Yeah. Sometimes we'll cut a little collage together of like all our favorite bits. And then we sort of together come up with the palette. Mm. And you know, based on what Mark sends you. And it's so great. You go over to his studio, Mutato, which is on Sunset in this like beautiful green building.
Like circular building that looks like a spaceship.
And then he'll have like a synthesizer like lying around that was, you know, they composed Powerhouse on it, 85 years ago. And you're just like, you're a kid again. That's the thing. It's like you have a sense of wonder working with that guy.
That's amazing. This week's Filmmakers Podcast is brought to you by Massive, the fastest way to send and receive massive film and video files. Send uncompressed dailies, locked pictures, DCPs, and more with Massive. Spelt M-A-S-V. Keep listening to hear how you can receive 100 gigabytes for free towards your next transfer. Massive. And going back to, you talked about their collaborating, creating something, when you're collaborating together at the beginning and you're finding these ideas, and I suppose what would be fascinating for us is, how do you actually find these ideas? Is it a load of different ideas going together, and how do you write them down? Is it a same thing as your composer here is just on the back of a napkin and stuff? Or?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, we've talked often about that, like, we've never had a good answer to, like, where do you get your ideas? Mm-hmm. And I don't know if I've ever heard a good answer from anybody else. I guess I could say I get them from Chris.
I mean, I think you're sort of in this, yeah, and I get mine from Phil, so it's, sort of, it's a circular situation. But I think it always starts with a what-if type of conversation. And I think I have this theory that there's a reason why a lot of people, a lot of creative people and writers are anxious people that are on mood stabilizing drugs.
Are you guys? Yes.
Or not?
No, I'm not.
Cocaine.
I just live drugs. With my anxiety.
Yeah. What's this lines of powder we got on the table here? What's that about? Yeah.
I think that anxiety is sort of an overblown what if.
Yeah.
You're in bed at night and you hear a noise downstairs and your brain goes like, it's a burglar. I'm going to go down there with a bat, but he's going to have a gun. Or it's a dog that, it's a dog woke up and it knocked over a lamp, or it's this or it's that. And you come up with all these different scenarios in your head and you start like playing out these scenarios, and some of them are more fantastical than others. And the more of a creative person you are, the more fantastical those what if scenarios are and the more anxious you become.
Right. The main reason that we have stories. There's like two.
Right.
One is so we can imagine future outcomes and make decisions, right? Yeah. And a related one is so that I can tell him what happened to like Bill. Did you hear he got too close to that cliff?
Mm-hmm. He ate the red berries.
He ate the red berries.
And he died.
Fell asleep. Yeah. Yeah. And yeah. Fell right off the cliff. And he died.
He got really close to the mastodon and he got trampled
to death.
Don't
get too close to the mastodon. Don't eat the red berries.
Yeah, let me tell you an exciting story about this.
Don't get too close to the edge of the cliff.
I'm warning you how to survive. And or I'm telling you how about we could do something like this and the world would be a better place.
Yeah, so stories are a really important technology if you want to stay alive.
Right.
And that's why we all still have it.
Yeah.
What you're telling me is you have a good escape plan.
Right.
From your house.
Absolutely.
Oh, yes. Go
every
wrong.
Scenario yeah. has been thought out.
Yeah, we're on the second floor. Yeah. If I jump out this window, I'll probably break a leg.
When you move house.
If I push him first.
Yeah, you could land on him.
Yeah, land on him. Right. That's probably okay.
I thought of an escape right no, here.
No,
right
we're not here for long. But
right. Yeah, and I don't feel house. Really under threat.
I realized I didn't have my new escape plan in my new house. I was like, oh no, I don't have my, which has been, there for years.
I'll tell you what, that the lords, since they came over from this country to America, have tied ropes to bedposts in case they needed to escape.
Yeah.
Serious?
Yeah. When I went to college and my dad gave me like a hug, like $100 and a rope.
And oftentimes it's sort of like, this scene isn't good enough. I'm anxious that it's not special enough. Like, what can we do to make it more interesting and more special? And so it's all anxiety.
That whole idea. How about putting it down? Like you say, you come up with these ideas and they come up from anxiety, but do you block it out? Do you just splurge stuff? Well, tell us about.
You're more of a block it out guy, and I'm more of a vomit it onto the page and then pray that there's anything good there.
Well, I think there's sort of something that we learned from a speech by John Cleese, that there's like an open mode and a closed mode. And when you're in the open mode and there's sort of like the creativity is flowing, you can feel, oh, this is the time when we're generating ideas and they're exciting and they're getting us all jazzed up. You don't want to sort of block it with a lot of editing thoughts at that moment. You really just want to explore everything and just throw out as many ideas as you can, because that's a really special time. And then after that sort of wanes, you can go back and then look at it with an editor's eye and go like, oh, what really actually works and what do we need for the story? And we could use this thing, but we'd have to adjust it this way. And this is a great idea, but it sort of is contrary to what we're trying to say.
We try not to short circuit things, ideas before they happen, right? So if we're working on something and he brings up, what about this? We just try to chase it instead of question it before it's, before you even know.
Thinking live action wise, are you the same effectively when you're writing? Is the energy the same when you're on set, or is it a completely different dynamic, or how does it work? How do you both change from in a room, just the two of you, to on set?
Yeah, it's really about how does the anxiety manifest?
Right. Well, I think one of the things is that we talk about the scenes so much beforehand, and we sometimes have a lot of different ideas or things we want to get. And when we're on set together, you want to present a united front to the actors so they don't get bombarded with contradictory ideas and not know what to do. And so we sort of try and present a single idea.
Do one thing at a time.
Yes.
And if we have a disagreement about like, oh, I think this should be like animated and yelling at each other, then we wait until we do Chris's idea, which is like, what if we play it really soft? We do that first and then rev them up at the end.
I say, okay, now that we've done that, let's just try another version. That's a totally different thing. Instead of like going, let's try it soft but loud.
A lot of times when we're on set, like watching a take, you're just watching it with your body. Mm. One of the things we try to remember is like, you make these things with your frontal lobe, but you watch them with your stomach.
Yes.
Right? So yes. You sit there and you're watching a take and trying to like listen to your body and whether you're leaning in or out. And you might get an idea that's just sort of intuitive and you just try to chase that. And we'll pitch things out. A lot of times, depending on the performer, we'll just throw lines at them in the middle of the scene.
Mm. And you're working with some amazing performers on your first. So that was your first live action? Yeah, for sure.
Which one?
Both those guys are really great at taking lines in the middle of the scene. So you're kind of writing the scene with them as you shoot it. Yeah.
And it's been great. In all of the stuff, we try to work with people who are good improvisers because they can sort of put it in their own words. And it's like free writing that you're getting from these people that are filmmakers themselves. And so it's just greedy.
Yeah. Yeah. But in a wonderful way. And how did going into, Jump Street real quick, and so, coming from animation side and creating ideas, and suddenly you're now working with the real camera.
Yeah.
Was there any talk us through the differences between, because
it was a lot to learn, just the physical realities of like, you need to get a camera and a dolly and a person in that space. You can't just put the camera like magically, put the lens right against the wall. There was a lot of that stuff. We have a great cinematographer we work with named Barry Peterson. And Barry was really patient with us and taught us some really smart things, that we now brought into animation. He has a philosophy, which is like tight eyelines are great for comedy. And that's basically true. And also like to taught us to think about where the lens is relative to the story. If you're focusing on Phil and like Phil's mind's eye and like experiencing the movie through his point of view, get the camera as close to him as possible so that even if I'm looking at Chris, I'm looking at Chris from more or less Phil distance, I'm entering the room that way. So just trying to make things as subjective as possible, which, if you look at like Clone High and even Cloudy, like it's quite objective, right? It's like treating the characters as like Muppets. And so now we've tried to bring some of that stuff into our animation too.
That's amazing.
It's quite frustrating actually for you guys, because there's so much we can talk about, because this is, reminds me of the David Kep interview we did.
Oh, he's nice, like,
where do you begin? Like, oh my God, even the smaller stuff is like, well, there's so much, but Last Man on Earth.
Oh yeah.
Because that feels like, that's got a lot of your, as you say, it's kind of means, it's mean, but it's loving. It's got an amazing heart
to
it.
Well, Forte, that's one of the things he's so good at, right? He plays these like despicable people with so much humanity. And
vulnerability.
Yeah, they're so desperate, his characters. And I love that about Phil Miller. I love that about that character, that he wants it so bad. and shooting that pilot was one of the best experiences we ever had. Mm. Just because we'd known Will for so long, and before any of us were could, you know, afford to quit our day job. And so we got to like, and we just love his comedy so much. We were just trying to serve it as well as we could.
Mm. How early were you involved with Last Man, or how much
we came up with it together with Will? There was a movie idea that was like a scrap of an idea that we couldn't figure out, which was sort of this idea that, like, in an apocalypse, Phil and I thought we would be absolutely useless because we have no real world skills. All of our, you know, anything we know how to do, we know from the internet. And so if there was no internet, I couldn't fix a car. Yeah. I couldn't do anything. I'm not very
useful. Climb out of a window if a rope was tied to a bed. And
so,
all that
exactly.
Kind of stuff.
Yeah. And so like, oh, you know, just the thought about like how sad and pathetic we would be in an apocalypse, we thought was funny. And then we wanted to make a show with Will because, you know, he's been our friend for a long time and we think he's a genius. And we pitched a bunch of things and we talked back and forth about some different ideas. And then very late in our conversation, which was like a 2-day conversation, we pitched out this little nugget and he really latched onto it. And then in like a week, less than a week later, he had like figured out a whole season's worth of a story arc and a bunch of characters. And he really, really like sparked to it. And it really is a show that fully came out of his brain. But it all started in his
On the set of a Peter Bogdanovich film that he was making. Oh, yeah. I got to meet Bogdanovich.
Yeah, how cool was that?
He liked Jump Street.
Yeah,
that's what he said.
Did he?
He said, keep doing live action.
He said, keep doing live action. Yeah,
don't do those animations.
Don't do any more animations. Just,
we'll keep sort of alternating.
But talking about animation, I suppose, bringing it back to what Mitchell vs. Machines, but also we do want to talk about Lego Movie a bit, but let's talk about Mitchell vs. Machines here, because obviously you didn't direct this one, but yet it's massive. Your baby as well. Talk us through how that is different as well. Talk us through Mitchell's from the Machines first of all, and how that came about, and how it's different when you're just producing something. And
sure. So that movie is written and directed by Mike Rianda. It's based on his experience growing up. His dad was like a woodsman, and he was like an animation dork, like growing up and wanting to become a filmmaker. And they struggled to get to understand each other for a long time. And as a matter of fact, I think through making the movie, their relationship got stronger. So he was working at Sony Animation and kicking this idea around. And we saw him in the hallways. We met because there was like clearly one guy, one kindred spirit on this floor, because there was a normal door, and then a bunch of papers spilling out of this office and like Charlie Brown pig pen squiggles flying out of it. And it, that was like, oh, that was what our cloudy office looked like. You know, right. Basically he occupied more or less the same office that we had on the same floor in the Sony Animation building.
You've become the Andy Warhol figure. He's him. I want him.
Yes.
Yeah. And so we were working on Spider-Verse at that time. And so we met him and thought he was great. And then they asked us to watch the early animatic of a thing that the movie he'd been working on to see if we wanted to come help get it greenlit by the studio. Mm. And we watched this animatic and it was still very early and he had done all the voices for all the characters, male and female. you know, these like little scrappy storyboards, but you could tell even early on that he was really funny and he understood how to execute a joke, but he also understood emotional relationships and why that was important for a film as well, which was something that we had to learn during Cloudy. We're like, oh, this guy's already ahead of where we were on our first film. And so we thought he was really talented, and you know, part of our agenda as producers is to help a talented filmmaker sort of execute their vision to its best self. And so we jumped on board.
We talk a lot about like if think projects are on mission or not. Mm. You know, for nice. Us, you know, we're trying to put good things into the world as best we can and to help other people do the same. And so, you know, we do hope to be able to have great collaborations with other filmmakers. And so it was really on mission. We saw the movie and we really got it and we thought it was lovely and hilarious. And
then we spent 3 years like working on it.
And we're like, this will be easy money.
Yeah, this is an easy one. Yeah, in and out, quick, one day.
We had to sort of break it down and then build it back up to sort of make sure that it was its best self. And it still is a lot like that early screening. It's just sort of...
It's sweeter.
Yes.
What's your biggest... Because there's an energy and pace, the stuff that you guys are involved with. Did you bring that to Mitchell's?
If anything, we slowed Mitchell's down.
Really? Wow, because it is... No. It's rapid fire. I remember
it's Lego so
movie.
Fast.
Lego Movie, yes. I remember first watching that and thinking, like, wow, it's like an assault. It's, but
yeah. What you can't believe about Lego Movie is it moved even faster.
Wow. Really?
And we had a test screening. And the movie, believe it or not, played, people said it felt long, which means they disengaged. And the studio was there and they were really worried because animated movies score really high. So like that movie did like an 88 or something like that out of 100.
Which is good,
a Pixar movie does like a 97. So they're like, we're dead. We're never going to. We're like, okay, calm down. And they're like, you got to take 10 minutes out of the movie. That's the only way it's going to work. And we're like, okay, no problem. We'll take 10 minutes out of the movie.
They say it in a very aggressive kind of...
I'm playing it up a little bit. It was more like, you guys, you're going to take 10 minutes out of the movie. I'm sorry. Okay, so very genteel. And so we agreed, which was a lie, because the truth was you needed to put... And this is what we did. We put 10 minutes into the movie.
Right.
But to make it longer so that every moment you had a second to digest it and understand, not just like you said something, but I got to watch what you said land on the other character. And then I watched them process it, think about what they were going to say, and then say it back. It's that those moments in between that are really important.
How did you know to do that, though?
Well, because we did it wrong first, and we watched it, and we're like, "This is like, you, I hate this."
I'm not connecting with the character, and so we cut 5 minutes of material, but added 10 minutes.
And did they notice?
Played like a rocket. Right. That's the thing, because you're engaged, you're locked in the whole time,
right.
And nothing knocks you out.
You've taken the time to sort of feel what Emmett is feeling in that movie and be on the journey with him and empathize with him in a way that if it's just like coming at you at an assault, you never get a chance
to do it. If the movie's talking at you, it doesn't allow you to do the thing, the magic trick that we all can have been able to do since birth, which is imagine what someone else is thinking. So if you give me the real estate, like a little pause, I get to project onto Emmett what's going on inside of him. But if he's just chattering the whole damn time, I never get a shot.
And so, you know, in Mike's first thing, it was very like, he's trying to cram as many jokes and bits as possible. He's just excited to get away with the movie the way that we always have been. And then, so we had to be like, okay, we need some moments where we can like slow this thing down and open up and
reaction shots.
Empathize.
Just like have like if Katie and Rick are having an argument at the dinner table, finding a moment to look over at Linda and look at Aaron and watch what they're thinking about it. And that's part of the story. And so much of it was just like the camera was on whoever was talking.
Okay, with that, does that mean you've got to go back into... You've got to animate.
Oh, it's a nightmare.
Adding 10 minutes.
It's terrible. Everybody hates you.
Yeah, I was going to say.
When we're looking at it early on, it's storyboards that we're looking at on an animatic. So it's much cheaper and easier to try a million things out. And we tried so many things out. And there's 100 different versions of this movie that are on the cutting room floor.
But we're famous at Sony for never thinking the movie is done. And even though the hardworking line producers are telling you, the shot is finished. No, it's not.
No, it's not.
Because we need to add 12 frames on the end of it. But it's finished. It says so on the spreadsheet, but someone's going to just open it up and we're just going to add 12 more frames.
Is that easier now that you've got a reputation?
It's a little easier now, yeah. But yes. It is still, yeah, it took us a few movies to learn that about us. But I think the results speak for themselves. And the artists all, when they saw that the movie was playing better, then everybody was on board.
Yeah, and they trust you. Like Christian says, they trust you now that you know what you're talking about in terms of go, look, we're going to add 12 frames. We are. Right. Or at least you're in a position to...
You know you're going to do it. You can fight me on it. Wait a week and then do it anyway. Or you can just do it.
But I'll have you fired.
But you know I will find a way. I'll go around you and I'll talk to the animator on the weekend and it'll happen.
So just behind your back.
Accept it.
Yeah, do it now. Let's all film. But no, but it is nice, I think, in a way that you, like you say, you know it's worth it in the long run, even though it might cost more now and we've got to put those line items back in the budget. The fact is, at the end of the day, you're making brilliant projects and brilliant projects. You know, it's true. They are. You've made some amazing films. There's no question about
that. Well, that's very
right?
kind
don't,
of
get
you.
Big heads. Don't get big heads. Oh my goodness. You don't care. Walk out of the room.
Playing to the buzzer, you know, running through the tape, as we say, is really important. It's those last little details. And the mix can make a huge difference.
Got to leave it all in the pitch, guys.
You know?
Right.
Because like if you mix it wrong and there's too much information and you're getting repelled by all the loud sounds, you can't watch it. You know?
Well, that must have happened a bit on the Lego Movie because it was a absolute, wow, this
it's
is
so much happening.
Yeah. I laughed so hard. I absolutely enjoyed it. I took the kids to see it in the cinema and we laughed our heads off. It was brilliant.
Oh, and they weren't even his kids.
They weren't even, so. I just picked them up. But what was amazing about it was I imagine that you went even further and maybe you had to bring stuff back.
Oh, for sure. Even on the sound mix, you know, like it's, you know, it can be overwhelming and you don't know what to look at because like everyone's walking around and clickety clackety click click clack, and so we had to just like take a lot of stuff out. So that
mix was about removing things, so that because you know there's like 100 characters on screen, everything's jittering. You needed to tell people what to look at, by what was on the soundtrack,
right? Yeah. And that can't be easy, right?
It's a big pain in the neck.
Big pain.
Yeah. On Mitchell's, for example, like we added 4 weeks to the mix at the end, two of which we paid for ourselves because it just couldn't.
The line producer was like, no!
Yeah, we're like, we're paying for it. We'll try to, sometimes that's a move we do is we say we'll pay for it and then we shame them into doing it. It's a bit of a game of chicken.
But sometimes we end up actually paying for it.
In this case, we actually
because we
pay
care
for it.
So much about excellence. So, you know, it's worth it.
It makes a difference. It really does.
It really does. Hence why, you know, award season and stuff for Mitch was absolutely right. I mean, it's fantastic, and it's totally deserves the awards. And everyone who has should go sit. But
we're super proud of it. I'm so proud of Mike and happy for all of the people, you know, his whole crew. You know, this is a lot of people's first movie. Lindsay Oliveris, who's the production designer, it's her first time ever in that job. Guillermo Martinez, who was the head of story, that was his first time in that job. Mike's first movie. Jeff Rowe, the co-director, his first movie. So it has the energy of like film students.
Yeah.
And that's what's so fun. That part of us has long since died. So it's great to be with them.
That's Disney for you.
We suck off the energy of their youth, and so it keeps us young.
We're like vampires sucking their life force.
I can see that. You've got a very nice complexion. Your skin is very smooth.
You guys have great necks, by the way. I work on it a lot. And then there's like big targets.
I've never had that.
No one's ever said that to me before. But if you could look back and give your younger self some advice in terms of all those times you were getting the knockbacks, shall we say, what advice would that be that our listeners can maybe take from, learn from, and be inspired by?
It's part of it, you know, to embrace the failures. And for every success we've had some often public failure to go along with it. You know, that's just learning. That's just filmmaking. You make a bunch of bad stuff along with the good stuff. And it's just lessons. So the nice thing about animation and even those Jump Street movies, like you get to make 10 bad versions of the movie before the last one. And then you watch those and learn from your mistakes.
Right. And I say, you know, don't chase something because you think it's what people want to see, what a studio wants to see. Make something that is what you want to see that you think is special and is something that only you could make. I think sometimes early in our career, we're like, well, this feels like a movie that would be made. It's not something I personally care about that much. It has to be something that you really are passionate about and want to spend every waking moment of your life thinking about, because that's what ends up happening. These things take a long time to make.
Very quickly. So you've achieved a lot. How do you still make sure you still love what you do?
I've always liked the mark making of it. Like, I've always liked to draw. I've always liked to type. You know, I love to edit. I love to capture things on film, whether it's animated or live action. I love presenting this stuff. So I really like the day-to-day of it. And that gets me up in the morning.
Yeah,
I feel like you just like the action of it.
Oh yeah, I like the excitement of feeling like you're putting something new out into the world. And I think that's what keeps me excited. If I felt like I was just doing a thing that you've seen before, it would be hard to spend as much time as we have to spend on these things.
Yeah.
And because, you know, with Mitchell's, it's, you know, the even how it looks, the animation itself is totally new, and it has this very watercolor illustrative style with this mixed media on top of it, and that felt very exciting and new. And so it was always exciting to like go in and see how far we could push the look of the movie.
Like today I was like watching a cut of a Clone High episode.
Oh yeah.
And just like writing up notes, like I just like doing it. I like watching it and seeing if I can help make it better, you know? The same thing was, you know, walking around Aardman yesterday. One of the things that was so special was watching Peter watch the filmmakers like working on a shot, and even watching him like light up and start asking about it. And I could tell wanting to make some adjustment and holding himself back out of pure politeness. But you could tell that guy's been doing it as long as he has, and he still has he's still curious. Yeah.
This has been amazing. Thank you both so much. Honestly, really, really appreciate your time.
This was a great interview, guys. Thank you. Thanks
for taking the time with us.
Thanks, I should say. Yeah. It's been fun.
Remember, you can go out there and make your film, your indie film, your animation, whatever it is, just as the boys have said. And if you're lucky enough to rise up and do well, it is your duty, as always, to send the elevator back down. We will see you all next Tuesday, as always. Oh, wow. Thank you so much, both of you.
Thank you
so much. Cheers, CJ.
Cheers.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.